You're listening to The Stressless Life with Dr. Yip, the podcast about conquering your fears and overcoming anxiety. Our question for the day is, what is a panic attack and why should we habituate to them? I'm your host, Noah Larracy. Let's say hello to Dr. Yip.
Hi, Noah.
Dr. Yip is a licensed psychologist who's board certified in behavioral and cognitive therapy and an expert in the treatment of anxiety and OCD. Okay, so today we're going to talk about panic attacks, which means that we have to, for the one and only time on this podcast, talk about the DSM and what it is. So what is the DSM?
Well, the DSM is kind of like the Bible for us. It is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and the current edition is the fifth. So we're currently using the DSM-5, and that is kind of our guideline to determine what are the specific symptom presentation that a person suffers from to determine what specifically is the diagnosis.
Who comes up with the DSM?
Many people. Many researchers are in specific task force boards of the DSM. So, for example, there's a task force specifically for anxiety disorders. So some of the top researchers in the U.S. are in the task force for anxiety disorders in the DSM-5.
The reason why I bring this up is today we're talking about panic attacks, and the list of symptoms for what constitutes a panic attack is very, very long. So let's talk about first, what exactly is a panic attack?
Well, a panic attack is an abrupt sensation of fears. The person experiences intense discomfort. Some of the sensations that a person fears or experiences could be sweating, palpitations of the heart, like a pounding heart, like it's going to come out of your chest. You might be trembling and shaking, feeling shortness of breath, or feeling like you're choking. You'll feel chest discomfort. Some people even feel nausea and dizzy, and even hot or cold transfers in temperature in their limbs and fingertips. There are many different sensations that a person can experience when having a panic attack. The most important point here is that most people who experience a panic attack feel like they're going crazy or they're going to die because the sensation is so intense. It's almost like having a jolt of lightning bolt going up your spine. And that's what it feels like to have a panic attack.
How would I know a panic attack versus, like, for instance, a heart attack?
They're very, very different. So first of all, let me explain that a panic attack is basically when you feel a sensation and you automatically attribute that something is wrong. So for example, let's say I feel my heart skip a beat. Rather than perceiving as, oh, okay, well, my heart just fluttered. Okay, it's no big deal. The person with panic attacks will attribute that sensation to something going wrong with the heart. So rather than saying, oh, okay, it's no big deal, the person goes, oh my goodness, I must be having a heart attack. Why else will my heart have skipped a beat? There's something wrong. And as soon as you do that, uh-oh, something's wrong, you turn that alarm off. So you remember when we talked about the fight or flight response last week?
That would be in episode one.
Okay, so in episode one, we talked about the fight or flight response. And when we experience the fight or flight alarm, what happens is that we perceive some threat, some harm. And because our brains cannot tell the difference whether it's a true harm or a false alarm, our brain simply interprets it to be true and it responds by producing a bunch of hormones, various different hormones, to trigger energy, to give us energy to either fight or run from this potential threat. So when we experience a panic attack, again, what's happening is we are perceiving danger. My heart just fluttered. Uh-oh, something is wrong. So automatically, you send signals to your brain, and the signals to your brain automatically triggers the flow of norepinephrine, adrenaline, all of these sensations that we need to give us the energy to either fight or run.
In episode one, we talked about fight or flight. It seemed like it had some sort of evolutionary value, right? There was a sort of a survival mechanism being enacted. Whereas with panic attacks, they just seem awful and completely sort of counterproductive. So I was curious, what sort of purpose do they serve?
Well, you have to remember that you're perceiving a danger to have occurred. Now, whether the danger is true or false, you actually don't know that, right? So let's say that you felt your heart flutter and you automatically go, uh-oh, I must be having a heart attack. Well, that could be a true danger if you truly were having a heart attack. So most people, they'll go to the hospital, they'll get themselves checked out, they'll get an EKG, and the doctor will say, you know, you're actually fine. Nothing bad happened to you. So that's confirmation to you, well, okay, why was my heart doing what it was doing? And that's your signal that, well, maybe it wasn't a heart attack. Maybe it was something else. And the thing about panic attacks is that all you need is that one small trigger. And that trigger could be, I can't breathe. Okay, so sometimes, for example, if you've ever been in really hot weather and it feels humid and muggy and you can't breathe, you might start believing that you're choking. Or it could be that you're starting to shake, your limbs are sweaty. Anything that is a physical sensation that you do not like, you will attribute it as something bad is about to happen. And again, your brain doesn't know whether it's true or not, it simply responds. So does it have an evolutionary value? Of course it does. Just because it has an evolutionary value does not necessarily mean that we're all applying it effectively and usefully. That is where the problem is.
How common are panic attacks then?
It's actually quite common. Recent statistics show that about 33 million Americans suffer from panic attacks. Now, I do want to point out that a panic attack is not the same as a panic disorder. And you can have a panic attack to anything. So for example, I can be afraid of speaking in public. And when I have to speak in public, I might have panic attacks. Or I might be afraid of flying. And when I have to fly, I might have a panic attack. Panic disorder is very different. A panic disorder is when you fear the internal bodily sensations. And it's the internal bodily sensations themselves that trigger the panic attack. Think of it this way. In a panic attack, you have external triggers. A spider, height, speaking in public. Whereas it becomes a panic disorder when those external triggers aren't the only things that are triggering this panic disorder or panic attacks. It's now the internal bodily sensations that trigger the panic attack. And that is when it becomes a panic disorder. Now, a panic disorder, about 6 to 9 million Americans suffer from panic disorder versus the 33 million from panic attacks.
Panic attacks, then, how long do they usually last?
Usually, it lasts a very short time. Definitely no more than 30 minutes. Though, when you are in a state of panic, it might seem like forever. If you've ever been in an uncomfortable situation, it can seem like a lifetime. And for people who suffer from panic attacks, it really does feel like they're in the state of panic for a very long time.
So after the 30 minutes, what happens? Like, why do they stop?
Well, because again, your body can only stay at a heightened fight or flight mode for only a short period of time. You know, the general rule of thumb is it's about 60 to 90 minutes. Your body simply cannot put out that much energy for that prolonged period of time. So therefore, just with the passing of time, your fight or flight energy has to decrease.
Let's just say right now I'm having a panic attack. I get Dr. Yip on the phone. What should I do? What are you going to tell me?
Well, one of the things that we do here with patients at the Renewed Freedom Center is that we teach them something that's called interoceptive exposures. And interoceptive exposures basically invokes these internal bodily sensations that we don't like. So for example, if having your heart beat fast is a trigger for you, then our goal is to be in a safe, contained environment and actually get the heartbeat going. And we can get the heartbeat going by doing jumping jacks, running up and down the stairs. Any physical activity will get the heartbeat going. And once the heartbeat is up, then within passing of time, just by doing nothing, you experience what we call habituation. And habituation is basically when your discomfort level slowly comes down on its own. And that's basically what interoceptive exposures are. So have you ever experienced interoceptive exposures?
I'm not sure. I'm sure you're gonna tell me.
Well, if you've never tried interoceptive exposures, I suggest that you can give it a shot and see what the person who's really suffering will have to go through as well. Some other types of interoceptive exposures that we do, for example, if a person is afraid of feeling dizzy and triggering that nausea, vomiting sensation. So we do have a lot of people who suffer from vomit phobias. We would put them in situations that would trigger the discomfort of feeling dizzy, vertigo. So we might put them in a spinning chair and have them spin in circles for 30 to 60 seconds. We might have the person spin in circles themselves. We can have them swing their head from side to side to produce that dizzy sensations. So those are just some of the few exercises that we have our patients do if they fear feeling dizzy and nausea.
Well, let's talk a little bit more when you say habituation.
Okay.
What exactly does that process mean and sort of how does that work?
Well, habituation generally means that you simply feel like the discomfort is going away. So remember, what is producing the discomfort is the fight or flight alarm, right? It's the fight or flight energy. And when we have an excess of it, it's kind of like, I don't know what to do with myself. You feel the jitters. However, if I asked you to go and run around the block a couple of times, then that energy will slowly go away because you've used up the energy. Though in reality, if you have an excess amount of energy, the energy has to come down on its own without you doing anything. Just by you sitting there, your energy has to decrease. This is why by bedtime, we're all tired and we need to recharge. So this essentially is what habituation means. Other examples, I can ask you to poke yourself. Okay, so let's say that what I'm doing right now is I am pushing my nail into my forearms and I'm leaving my nail there. And initially, and my nail isn't that sharp actually, so I'm not feeling much. No, okay, let me put more pressure in here. So initially I feel that poke and I feel that sensation. Though if I leave my nail here and it's been about 15 seconds, that sensation is slowly going away. And over time, I'm not even going to feel that at all. And I'm not doing anything. I'm just leaving that nail exactly where it's been. So just by doing nothing, your skin habituates to that sensation. And the reason why this happens is that when we are experiencing discomfort, when I'm putting this nail in my skin, there are neural firings occurring, which gives me the sensation of pain. And the purpose of that is to remove yourself from that pain, from that painful situation, right? So that you're not hurting yourself. The thing about habituation is that those neural firings aren't going to keep going. It's going to slowly go away. Just like any type of energy, it's going to slowly lose that energy. And that's essentially what habituation is. It's basically you're putting yourself in uncomfortable situations. And why is it that we put ourselves in uncomfortable situations?
So we can conquer our fears and realize that we can overcome them.
Yes. And when we confront our fears, what we're actually doing is we are giving ourselves opportunities to relearn that this fear is not that threatening. And in order to give ourselves that opportunity, we actually have to confront and engage with the fear, with the discomfort. So we put ourselves into these uncomfortable situations so that we learn to tolerate the discomfort. It's kind of a paradoxical understanding of this. If you never put yourselves in uncomfortable situations, then your comfort zone will always be that small. In order for your comfort zone to expand, you have to learn to tolerate the discomfort.
If a patient comes in, and how do you sort of convince them to undergo such a process? In other words, if you want to instigate these feelings of going crazy and being incredibly uncomfortable, how do you get them to agree to it?
For most people, the experience of a panic attack itself is so uncomfortable that they are willing to do what's necessary to get rid of the panic attacks. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who have succumbed to the use of substances to escape from the discomfort, though the reality is interoceptive exposures, and which is a part of CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, is a way for you to engage with the discomfort so that you learn it's not that bad, you can actually survive, and over time, you begin to tolerate this discomfort. And the problem with not engaging with the discomfort is that the more you avoid, the more you're actually building and fortifying that prison you have around yourself, and over time, you can become agoraphobic, which is you don't feel safe leaving anywhere where it's just your comfort zone. And that space can be even as small as just your bedroom.
In summary here, if you suffer from panic attacks through interoceptive exposures, you can become habituated to them to a point where they occur less frequently. And if they do occur, you can endure them.
Absolutely. And again, because most people, when they experience panic attacks, the experience itself is so severe that they're willing to do what's necessary to get rid of them. And doing interoceptive exposures is a way. You have to keep in mind as well that these people are having panic attacks here and there. So it's not like doing the interoceptive exposure is anything new. It's something that they're already experiencing. The only difference of what we're doing is we are triggering them manually, and we're triggering them within a safe place, within a safe environment, and giving people tools so that they learn how to tolerate the discomfort. Now, the thing about panic attacks is that, especially with panic disorder, is that the sensation can be abrupt. They can happen at any time. So you can just be walking down the street and all of a sudden you feel like your chest is a little bit tight. And because it feels a little bit tight, you automatically go, uh-oh, there it goes again. There goes another panic attack. So doing the interoceptive exposures help you to tolerate whenever that abrupt, sudden sensation comes up out of the blue.
To end here, I know some people will take certain prescribed drugs,
absolutely,
Xanax and things like that, when they have a panic attack. What's your sort of thoughts about that?
Well, the unfortunate truth is that the medical community continues to prescribe such medications. These are benzodiazepines, which are very, very addictive. I've had patients come in taking over 7 milligrams of Xanax a day. You put me on 0.5 milligram and that will knock me out. So 7 milligrams of Xanax a day, that is certainly too much for a person to function. And when you're on these benzos, not only are they addictive, they aren't going to help you confront your fears, because taking that substance means that you're escaping from your fight or flight arousal. And that's the purpose of benzos. The purpose of the benzo is to drown out your autonomic nervous system so that you're not experiencing your fight or flight arousal, your fight or flight triggers. The thing is, most people who are taking the benzos, they'll tell you that they feel numb, that they can't think clearly, that they can't sleep at night unless they take more benzos, that they can't wake up in the morning, or when they do, they feel very, very drowsy. So these medications only put a Band-Aid on the problem, and it comes with a whole host of negative side effects. What a lot of my patients experience is that now that they learn to tolerate the discomfort with interoceptive exposures, comes the challenge of actually getting off of the benzos. So I've had quite a number of patients where it has been hellacious trying to get off of the benzos. So it's not a fun game at all.
Thank you for listening to the Stressless Life podcast. You can join the discussion and find more information at www.dryip.com/thestresslesslife. Please write to us with questions and comments at thestresslesslife@dryip.com. Until next time, stay stressless.